All right, good morning, everybody. It is Thursday morning, April 7th, 11:15 a.m. We're doing Chem 12A. This morning, we're starting Chapter 7. This is a pretty significant moment in terms of where we're at within the semester. With Chapter 7, we start looking at alkyl halides, we start looking at elimination, substitution reactions, a series of different reactions. We're also going to look at alcohols. Alcohols are kind of a component of this as well because of the types of reactions that we're looking at when we're doing substitution reactions. A lot of them turn out to be alcohols. And so we're going to go over some nomenclature of the alkyl halides, nomenclature of alcohols, certain positions, terms within organic chemistry that we use for these positions. And then once we start getting into the substitution and the elimination reactions, this is a fairly lengthy chapter. And I was looking at it, it's sort of been reorganized so that all of the substitution elimination reactions are in this chapter, although next chapter goes into alkenes. And there is some synthesis of alkenes, some reactions that take place in the alkenes as well. But it's these SN1, SN2, E1, E2 reactions that I've been saying that are the big component of the focus of the first semester. These are the challenging reactions to do. And much more so when we get into predicting them, which direction the reaction is going to go. So it's going to take me a little while to get through the substitution reactions and then through the elimination reactions and then come back together and put it all back together. And also, I present this a little bit differently than I've been presenting most material. What I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a series of reactions, a bunch of information, and we're going to take all that information. And then that information initially, as I present it, is not going to make sense. We're going to then take all that information and start picking it apart and start making sense out of it all. So it's presented with a little bit of mystery at first. And then at the end of it, we come back and we put a lot of numbers to it. We put a lot of data to it to really show perspectively how important each thing is. So bear with me while there's a lot of development that goes into this. It's not just you're going to understand everything all at once. It's going to come in bits and pieces, and then it's really going to all gel towards the end of this chapter as we get towards the end of it. So that's the idea. That's where we're going. Let me go ahead and start a screen share, and let's get into Chapter 7. It should come up. Chapter 7, alkyl halides, substitution, elimination reactions. A little bit about nomenclature. First off, the normal nomenclature that we've done already, no different until we get to alcohols, really. So nomenclature, we can name a few compounds here. Same things that we were doing before as we go through and name this. This is an alkyl halide. It's a bromo compound. We would go through and we would look at the numbering scheme. We could number it from right to left. We can number it from left to right. We find that the substituents on the blue scheme would fall 4-4. There's a substituent that is the bromide and the methyl, or in the red scheme, they would fall 2-2. And so the numbering is the lowest numbering system at the first point of difference. That's what we're doing, just as before, lowest numbering at first point of difference. And so I get two substituents out of this. I get a 2-bromo, I get a 2-methyl. This is a pentane. And so all of that combines to give me 2-bromo. It's actually not capitalized, unless it's the start of a sentence. They're not proper names as you would name a person, and so they're lowercase. 2-bromo, 2-methyl, and then pentane. Fairly straightforward. If we're doing a cyclic molecule, we can do a cyclohexane. We can put in a stereocenter into that. Numbering system in this would be the same. We would go with the lower number at the first point of difference. And so we could start numbering either at the methyls or at the chlorine. The chlorine has no greater or higher priority in terms of nomenclature than the methyls do. So really, we treat them all the same, and we just look at it at the first point of difference. So in other words, we could number going around counterclockwise, or we could number going around clockwise, in which case this would be one, this would be two, this would be three, and we could number around that way. Substituents here would fall one, comma two, comma two. In the red scheme, they would fall one, comma two. And again, we're looking at the lowest numbering at first point of difference. The red scheme would be the correct scheme. And so substituent wise, we would have one, comma one dimethyl. We would have two chloro. This is a cyclohexane. And then we got to deal with that stereocenter. So the stereocenter, we can't ignore it. When we see something like that, that is a stereocenter, then we've got to make sure that we hit it. So we got to go in, and I would recommend, rather than doing it on the same molecule, I would recommend redrawing to deal with the stereocenter. Go ahead and use the Kahn-Ingold Prelog rules to assign highest priority. Priority one to the chloride, priority two to the carbon, which has, so this is a carbon, which has carbon, carbon, carbon attached. This is a carbon, which has a carbon and then two hydrogens attached. So it gets lower priority, that's priority three. And then priority four is the hydrogen. I look at the molecule and draw the Newman projection with the hydrogen going back, lowest priority group back, not always a hydrogen, but lowest priority group going back. This would be the dimethyl group, the rest of the ring system. You can view it sort of going that way. This is number one, this is number two, this is number three. And you can see that I'm going around in a clockwise orientation from one to two, two to three, three back to one. So that's going to be an R stereocenter. So we come back over here and we hit this as well, that this is an R stereocenter, maybe putting that up in front. Because there's only one stereocenter, we don't need a locator number. So this can be R dash. Now we need to alphabetize on M and on C. C is going to come first, then M. So it is going to be 2-chloro dash 1,1-dimethyl cyclohexane. Okay. So that's how we would go through and do those. Let's talk about nomenclature for alcohols. For alcohols, the rules change a little bit. The alcohol must be part of the parent chain. So alcohol must be part of the parent chain when it is the highest priority functional group. An alcohol can be a substituent if there's a higher priority functional group in the molecule, but if the alcohol is the highest priority functional group, then the alcohol must be part of the parent chain. And in addition, not only must it be part of the parent chain, it must have the lowest possible locant number. So if we're going through and we're looking at a molecule, let's do this one and we'll put the hydroxyl group here. Let's not worry about the stereocenter. I've created a stereocenter, but let's not worry about it. In this case, as we go through and we number, we could number this way, 1, 2, 3, 4, we hit 5, maybe we go out here to 6. Or we could number back the other direction. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Numbers here are going to fall 2, 2, 5 for the hydroxyl group. And under red, they would fall on 2, 5, 5. But the important part is where that hydroxyl group is located. Hydroxyl group on 5 versus hydroxyl group on 2. We want the alcohol to have the lowest possible number. And so the alcohol takes priority in its location as to how we number this molecule. So it's not just the lowest number at first point of difference, but the lowest number for the alcohol on the parent chain. So this becomes then a 2-all. It becomes a 5,5-dimethyl. And we are at a hexane. Oh, hexane. I won't do hexane, but hexane. So this is a hexanol. So the way that all of this works out is we do 5,5-dimethyl. And then it is hex N dash 2-all. The other acceptable name would be 5,5-dimethyl-2-hexanol. The differences between them is that this is an older IUPAC standard where the 2 is giving the location of the functional group, of the primary functional group, the alcohol. The one above is the newer IUPAC rules, where the locant number for the functional group for the parent molecule comes and precedes it with two dashes between the number of carbons in the molecule and the location of the functional group in the molecule. So I'll accept either of those names. Both are used interchangeably, but the correct one right now would be the strict IUPAC with the two following at the end of the, just preceding the OL. So that's an alcohol. If we want to do one more, slightly more complicated, we can do a cyclic one again. It's nice to see both linear and cyclic ones. Let's do, let's change this up. Let's do a 5-membered ring system. Let's do a stereo center again. We'll put the stereo center on the alcohol. We'll do digeminal methyls, and I'll put a second stereo center so that we can see that we need to keep track of both stereo centers. We could do the stereo centers first, or we could do them after. As soon as I see a stereo center, the problem is that if I jump in and I start trying to figure out everything about the locator numbers, I forget about the stereo centers. So maybe it's a good idea that when you see a stereo center, deal with it right away. Take it on first. So let's try and do the stereo center first, and then we'll come back and we'll deal with numbers. So in dealing with the stereo centers first, I'm going to deal with one, and then I'll deal with the other. Let's deal with the hydroxyl first. There's the hydrogen. Priorities, 1 for the alcohol, 2 over here, 3 for that, 4 for the hydrogen. And I'm viewing it head on. So as I view it head on and I look at this with the hydrogen going back, what I'm going to see in my sort of pseudo Newman projection is the hydroxyl group, priority 1, priority 2 on the right, priority 3 on the left. So as this spins around, you can see that this is going in a clockwise orientation. The first stereo center is an R. Let's do the second stereo center. I'll redraw the molecule. I like not having too much going on in one image. I find that if I'm going to do assignment of stereo centers or something of that nature, that I redraw it each time so that I make less mistakes. There's less clouding my work in order to be able to go through and and do them. Okay, hopefully, the hydrogen has lowest priority. So if I can assign highest, I do it. If I can assign lowest, I do it. And then there's things I got to sort out. Coming out here, here, and here. This is a carbon that has a carbon and two hydrogens on it. This is a carbon that has a carbon and two hydrogens. And this one is a carbon that has a carbon and two hydrogens. All three are the same, which means that I need to go to the next level. I need to bump out a particular direction. So in order to show, because this is the first time we've really done this, let's call this direction blue. Let's call this direction green. And let's go with, purple for coming out this direction. And we need to follow those directions out. And I'll do my second level here in blue. So this is a carbon that has three hydrogens on it. This one is a carbon that has three carbons on it. And finally, this one over here is a carbon that has a carbon on it, an oxygen on it. I'm going to list the oxygen first. List the oxygen first, actually. Then the carbon, then the hydrogen. Okay, so looking at those three, what takes the kicker is the oxygen has the highest atomic number and takes priority. And so that is going to be the first one. So purple is going to be number one. Blue is going to be number two. Green is going to be number three. Now I got to take all that work and I got to draw it somehow to make sense out of it in the Newman projection. And the problem is the hydrogen is forward. So I have to view this from behind. So I have to imagine grabbing this hydrogen and turning this whole molecule around. When I turn this molecule around, this may be challenging to do mentally. So sometimes I suggest that the best way to do this is just build a model and then physically turn the model around so that you make sure that you get everything in the right direction. If I flip this thing around, what I'm going to get is that this goes up into the ring. That's that group there. That's the ethyl group there. And the hydroxyl group is sitting over on this side without its stereo center. So I've just kind of flipped everything around. I think I missed it though. The digeminals are in the wrong spot. And nope, everything's twisted. Darn it, Jason. Come on, get it right. There we go, because I had to rotate it. And at that point, it may help to see that I've rotated it by adding the colors to it that I had. And you can kind of see how I've rotated around with the hydrogen in the back, right? And so now I can add my priorities to it, that priority one was purple, priority two was blue, priority three was green. And so I am going this direction, two, three, and one. I'm going counterclockwise. This stereo center is an S. Okay, now with the stereo centers under control, now I can go through and do the rest of it, put all the substituents in and number it. So let's get our numbering scheme going. Let's figure out what the correct numbering scheme is. We can agree that the alcohol, as I said, had to be the lowest locant number. So the alcohol takes one. Now I could go clockwise or counterclockwise. Lowest locant number is going to be to the geminal dimethyls. That'll be two, three, four, and five. So this one is going to be a one all, a 2-2 dimethyl, a 4-ethyl. And then for stereo centers, I've got number one is an R. So this is one R. comma, and 4S. And they go like that. And it's a cyclo. Pentane, but we're going to ditch the E and we're going to add the OL into this. So prioritization wise, it is going to be E before M. So I'll combine all of that together and the name becomes 1R, 4S. Those go in brackets. We've got then the first group, 4-ethyl, then dash 2,2-dimethyl, then we've got the cyclo pentane dash 1-all. And that's the whole name. Okay. So yeah, a little bit more complicated model there. Remember that when there is stereochemistry, that probably the first thing to do is deal with that stereochemistry. Get the stereochemistry under control, then go back, do the rest of the molecule. That way you don't forget the stereochemistry. Stereochemistry always goes out in front. Regardless of how many stereocenters there are, they go within the parentheses, out in front. Each one gets a locator number, unless there is just one stereocenter. If there's only one stereocenter, then it doesn't need a number. It's redundant to put the number because there's only one center. But if there's more than one, they must have their locant numbers associated with them. Okay, so that's the nomenclature component. Let's talk about types. By types, this is a little bit more about terminology, about how we refer to different types of positions. So alkyl halides and hydroxyls, these are primary. We can have things that are secondary. And finally, we can have things that are tertiary. So these are alkyl halides. And these are our alcohols. In addition to those, primary, secondary, tertiary, and as we're looking at primary, you know, the way that I recognize these are terminal, another way of saying that. Is that they are at the terminal end of a chain where there's two additional hydrogens on that carbon that they're attached to. So that is a primary. Secondary is where they're attached to a carbon that has two other carbons attached to it. So it's about the nature of how many carbons are actually attached to it. That's the other way of going back and looking at this. This has one carbon attached to it. So we could do it this way. Primary meaning one carbon, secondary meaning that it's on a carbon with two other carbons, tertiary meaning that it's attached to a carbon that has three other carbons on it. So there's how we're reading those. The other thing is when an alkyl halide is attached to a double bond or an alcohol, which is attached to a double bond. This position we call vinyl. Or we could say that it is vinylic. When we take the position and move the halogen one position away from the double bond, or the alcohol one position away from the double bond, then we call it allylic. Or this is an allele position. Or an allylic position. And then one more thing is if we have a triple bond and we're one position off the triple bond, or an alcohol one position off the triple bond, this is propargyl. Or propargylic. So just different ways in which we refer to these different types of groups. In terms of the types of carbons, when we look at the different types of carbons, we can take a molecule that has different groups attached, and we can look at the different types of carbons that we have in here. This carbon that has four other carbons attached to it, this is a quaternary position. A carbon which has three other carbons attached is a tertiary position. A carbon with two others is a secondary. And then if there are only one other carbon attached, that's our primary. And I will oftentimes refer to these types of positions here also as terminal, as a way to describe them.
Could you go up a little bit so I can see the propargyl structure again?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So four is called quaternary, three is tertiary, two is secondary, and then the one is primary. So we'll oftentimes refer to structures or positions by whether they are the quaternary center, the tertiary center, the secondary center, the primary center. It's really important to be able to identify those quickly in a molecule. I'll usually be pointing, but sometimes vocabulary-wise, as I'm speaking or referring to molecules, I'll be referring to different positions, and you need to be able to see or find those positions relatively quickly when I'm describing those different positions. So those are, and as always, I always think that sometimes it really helps to be able to look at that and to see that that carbon has the four different carbons attached, which is what makes it quaternary. So the way to think about that, just in terms of positions. All right, let's start our look at substitution reactions. So as we come into substitution reactions, in general, a substitution reaction looks like this. We have, I use R a lot. We have R with a leaving group, and we have some nucleophile. These two react such that the nucleophile replaces the leaving group. The leaving group can be negatively charged, can be neutral. The nucleophile can be negatively charged, it can be neutral. But in general, this is what we see. So R equals some molecule. LG equals the leaving group. The leaving group can be many different things. Oftentimes, it's a halide. but not always. The nucleophile can be many different things, as we'll see. The rate for this reaction, when I look at its rate, and this is a general rate. So this rate here, let me do it this way. Let's say that the general rate for all substitution reactions is that tertiary are faster than secondary, are faster than primary. And these are for our leaving group. Meaning that where the leaving group is on a tertiary center is fastest. And where the leaving group is on a secondary, it's a little bit slower. And when it's on a primary, it's a little bit slower yet. So this is in relation to the position of the leaving group. And again, this is a general rule, general rate. In other words, when we get to specific reactions, SN1 versus SN2, we'll look at the specific rates for those types of reactions. But if we take all substitution reactions, both SN1 and SN2, that in general, the tertiaries are faster than the secondaries are faster than the primaries. Let's look at some examples. Now, again, I'm just going to throw out a bunch of data of what these reactions look like. And then we will come back and we'll start putting or making some sense out of these. I can take an alkyl halide and react it with a sodium salt of a methyl thiol. So this is sodium thiolate. We can do this in a solvent. The solvent is THF. We can throw in a temperature, 25 degrees Celsius. And what we get is a product where the sulfur replaces the bromide. And the byproduct is sodium bromide. This runs in about a 95% yield. So just to clarify things here. This is our leaving group, where LG equals the bromide. This one is the nucleophile. Nucleophile almost always goes over the arrow. This one is the solvent. And then finally the temp. The solvent, we're going to use a lot of abbreviations for solvents. THF in this case stands for tetrahydrofuran. And it's an ether solvent of an oxygen in a 5-membered ring system, tetrahydrofuran. I will throw out sometimes solvents that we haven't seen before. Most of the time I will try to identify them. Sometimes when I use them over and over again, I'll try to remind you of what those solvents are. But in general, this is the style, is that it's nucleophile, solvent, temperature. Notice that when we write an organic reaction, since these are really the first organic reactions that we're looking at, that we don't write it in the classic way that we have written reactions in Chem 1A or Chem 1B. We don't write A plus B goes to make C. We usually put the nucleophile over the arrow as opposed to writing it next to the other reactant. This is just a way that we typically do organic reactions. We do this probably because we don't oftentimes get bogged down in the stoichiometry of how many equivalents of each thing are being used. And so we tend to write them over the arrow to not give the appearance that we're trying, that to say that we're purposefully not trying to keep track of stoichiometry is why we tend to do that in part. Okay, let's look at a few more. So actually I've got quite a few of them here to show you before we really start jumping into it and talking more. So we could take an alcohol and we can react this alcohol with hydrochloric acid, HCl. This goes at 25 degrees C. And it will make the tertiary butyl chloride and water will be the byproduct. This runs in about an 82% yield. We could look at the reaction of a secondary alcohol. Again, reacting with HCl. Notice that I have to up the temperature to 100 degrees C in order to make this reaction work. And it runs in about a 73% yield. Gives very similar product. Replaces the alcohol with a chlorine functional group. We can look at a primary. So we'll use butanol, N-butanol or 1-butanol. We'll react this with HCl. This requires 120 degrees C. And it replaces the alcohol in about a 90% yield, byproduct also water. So what are we seeing here? Just looking back at these three reactions, we could look at the substrate and the location of the alcohol, that this one is a tertiary alcohol, secondary alcohol, primary alcohol, and look at the temperatures. That what's going on here is that we start off temperature relatively cold for the tertiary. We have to warm this up as we go to the secondary, and then we have to get even hotter as we go to the tertiary. That's going along with what we said up here, was that the general rate was that tertiaries were faster than secondaries or faster than primaries. So because tertiaries run the fastest, we don't need to heat them up very much. Secondaries run slower, therefore we heat them in order to get them to go at a reasonable rate. Primaries go the slowest, so they need to be heated the most in order to be able to go at a reasonable rate. Another example, let's take that same alcohol, let's switch it up. Instead of doing HCl, let's do this with H2SO4. Actually, I'm going to change that. Let's do it this way. Let's do it with sodium chloride. And H2SO4 there, where I'm being consistent, and we'll add some heat to this. This will also replace the alcohol with the chloride. We get some water coming off of this and we get sodium hydrogen sulfate as a byproduct, about 80% in terms of yield. But what this is showing me is that I don't have to react these with acids. So as I was doing this, HCl is an acid, clearly, but I could react this with a salt as long as there's some acid component that's in it. I don't think I've used this symbol before, so let's define this symbol. This is a capital delta. And we use it to mean heat, usually refluxing. Reflux means boiling. So when we say reflux, we mean that we're taking it up to the highest possible temperature that we can take that solvent up to a refluxing temperature. All right, continuing on. These reactions can also look like this. We can have a tertiary reacting with methanol and heat so that we can replace the bromide. HBr would be the byproduct. Notice that I don't have any nucleophile written over the arrow, that this just has a solvent in it, and that this is replacement by solvent. So that can be a substitution reaction, where the bromide is the leaving group and the methanol is the incoming nucleophile. We can also do that on the primary alkyl halide. We can do this with strong base. So these can be done under basic conditions. OET, ETOH, where ETOH equals ethanol. So that's my ethyl group. This one here is sodium ethoxide. So the sodium is the counter ion, and the nucleophile is the oxygen connected to the ethyl group. And this one would give me that as a byproduct, or not as a byproduct, as the product. And it's going to be my sodium chloride. The byproducts I'm tracking for right now to show you, but we generally don't track the byproducts. We generally just look at the major part of the chemical reaction. So what we're seeing is that these substitution reactions, they can have various different types of nucleophiles. They can be acidic in nature. They can be basic in nature. They can have solvents. Sometimes they may not show the solvents. They can have salts as nucleophiles and acid being present. They could have no nucleophile, just a solvent being shown. Or they could be very basic in nature, and they can run at all different temperatures and conditions. And so what we're seeing here is that substitution reactions are diverse. We see a lot of different types of substitution reactions, or substitution reactions can look like a lot of different things. So there's not just one pattern that I can visually recognize and say, that's a substitution reaction. What I see that helps me to remember that is that I have some group that is changing in the same position, and that's a substitution reaction. And that's the main thing that I'm looking for, which is why I level it back down to this. R leaving group plus nucleophile goes to make R nucleophile plus leaving group. And I try to make it as general as I possibly can. All right, now getting into some specifics. We have two types. I've alluded to this already. There are two types of substitution reactions. There's SN1 and SN2. The way we write them, we subscript the N, although it's a capital N, we superscript the 1. So it's a subscript and a superscript. This equals substitution, nucleophilic, first order. So first order meaning first order rate law. You guys know what a first order rate law means. And then SN2 is substitution nucleophilic second order. So what we're going to do is we're going to pick up and look at SN2 first. SN2 is actually the easier of the two reactions to do. SN1 is slightly more complicated within the things that are going on within that reaction. So let's pick up at SN2 and let's look at SN2 and what that looks like. The rate for an SN2 reaction equals the rate constant times the concentration of our leaving group times the concentration of the incoming nucleophile. So there's my second order rate law. The reactions look exactly the same as what we've been doing. We have our leaving group reacting with some nucleophile, going to form our nucleophile plus leaving group. Now, I wouldn't say that this is always the case, but most often the nucleophile is an anion and the leaving group is an anion. But they can be neutral, so they don't have to be, or some combination. So those don't have to be absolutely there. The energy diagram, when I look at this reaction, generally looks like this. We have our leaving group as a reactant, reacting with a nucleophile, negatively charged. It goes to form a product, which is our nucleophile plus the leaving group. And I want that to snap in, and it probably won't. It just vexes me sometimes. Maybe what I should do is that. Or maybe what I should do is this. Ah, that's it. I think it's the attachment that it doesn't like. That's a little bit better. I always like it with a nice curve, but trying to get the drawing app to do the right thing is the hard part. This is a reaction mechanism that has one transition state and is a single step reaction mechanism. Usually, it's exothermic. The mechanism. The mechanism has the nucleophile attacking the carbon with the leaving group in it. And this carbon is tetrahedral in nature. So I'm not trying to say that the carbon is tertiary. I'm just trying to say that the carbon is tetrahedral in nature and that it can have different substituents on these carbons, or on this carbon. The nucleophile comes in and hits the backside of the carbon. And it specifically has to hit the backside of the carbon. The leaving group then breaks and takes its electrons with it. It goes through a transition state where the nucleophile is partially bound to the carbon, which is partially bound to the leaving group. And the carbon takes on a very close to trigonal planar geometry. We say that the carbon is undergoing what's called inversion of configuration. The nucleophile is partially negative. The leaving group is partially negative. And this whole complex is the structure of the transition state. So this group up here is what this looks like. That thing, when it breaks down, and the nucleophile is now attached to the carbon, which has undergone an inversion of configuration. So this is number one, number two, number three, and the leaving group has been kicked out as an anion. This is called inversion of configuration. You can think of this as if this were an umbrella, and the umbrella, if I were to take the umbrella, and you can imagine opening an umbrella so that the umbrella is kind of pointed towards the leaving group, protecting or shielding the leaving group, if you're thinking about an umbrella in rain. And then you can imagine somebody pushing the umbrella open even more to where the umbrella just goes totally flat. And then they push it even farther and the umbrella inverts and turns upside down. That's what we mean by inversion of configuration. And if I were to go through and I were to look at this, and let's say that the leaving group were the highest priority group and the nucleophile were the highest priority group. If this were initially an R stereocenter, it would invert to become an S stereocenter in the product. And that's what we mean by inversion of configuration. The rate for this reaction, I gave all of that to you, but I didn't draw the rate in terms of, and I want to get this on the same page, so I'm just going to move these all up just a little bit. I want to give you the specific rate for an SN2 reaction in terms of the substrate and leaving group. So the rate specifically for this reaction, the rate of an SN2 is that based on the substrate, equals primary is faster than secondary is faster than tertiary. Now, I realize that what I just told you here, that the rate of an SN2 is primary is the fastest and tertiary is the slowest. And that what I told you back up here in the notes, if I zoom back and we look at the general rate for all substitution reactions, that tertiary is the fastest and primary is the slowest. The reason for that is there's two different types of substitution reactions. And SN1 reactions in general are faster than SN2 reactions. And the fastest SN1 is a tertiary. But when we look at SN2, the order is different. SN2, the fastest are the primaries and the slowest are the tertiaries. But the difference is that in an SN1 where tertiary is the fastest, SN1s are still faster than SN2s. And so out of all of the substitution reactions in general, the tertiaries go fastest. But it depends on what SN2 reaction we're looking at, or excuse me, what SN reaction we're looking at. So with SN2 reactions, primary are faster than secondary, which are faster than tertiary. And by faster, I should also include here that it's not just a little bit faster, that these are way faster. So primary and secondary are much faster than tertiary. Okay, I know I went through a whole bunch of examples of SN of substitution reactions, but I want to show specifically now examples of SN2. So let's look at some examples here. Most of these will be primary and secondary. So this is a primary substrate. This primary substrate is reacting with sodium acetate. It's doing so in acetic acid. So I'm realizing that these abbreviations may be new. NaOAC is equaling sodium acetate. So this is the ACO minus and the sodium component. And ACOH then would equal acetic acid. This makes the substrate, the new bond, and the incoming nucleophile and attaches that incoming nucleophile to it. So I can capture this piece here as my nucleophile, my new bond that's been made. So there's an SN2 reaction. We can look at the reaction of a primary bromide reacting with a sulfur nucleophile. Again, I'll draw the new bond and the incoming nucleophile. Alcohols can undergo these reactions. This can be with HBr and heat. So under this primary alcohol, I will create the new bond and the incoming nucleophile. And finally, one last example. Bromide and alcohol, and this just requires heat. And what happens with this guy, this is a little bit more complicated to show what's going to actually happen here, but when I heat this up, one of these is the incoming nucleophile, the oxygen, and the leaving group, the bromide. And in this case, what I wind up doing is that if I look at the numbers and I number this system out, 1, 2, 3, actually, let's do it this way. Let's number from the oxygen. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. This is going to make a 5-membered ring system. I'm going to do the oxygen in blue. The rest of the system in black, the way that I've been doing it, and my new bond in red. And then I'll go through and number them again. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And so the reaction can also be an intramolecular reaction. It can be within a molecule where the reaction can happen as well. It doesn't have to be between two different molecules, that these reactions can take place within a molecule as well. And we can get reactions like that. So we need to do a little bit of reaction theory to explain how and why these reactions are taking place. So let's talk reaction theory for a minute. And then we can come back and we can sort of look at these and start to understand why these reactions are taking place, how they're taking place. Oh, but maybe what I should do too, while we're still here, I started it by saying that this was a primary. Let's catch this one here. This one is primary, primary, and primary. In terms of where the leaving group is, if I isolate the leaving group in each one of these cases, the leaving group is the iodide, the bromide, the hydroxyl group, and the bromide, and that they are attached on primary positions. And so, yes, I can do this on a secondary, and I haven't shown you any of those. But to see them this way, that these are primary positions, and that primaries, because their speed, because they're so fast, that any leaving group on a primary position typically goes SN2. Okay, back to this idea of reaction theory. Why does a chemical reaction take place? Why is this nucleophile replacing this leaving group? In one sense, it's just a pattern, and I'm showing you a pattern. But recognizing that pattern is not as important as understanding the mechanism underneath of why it's actually taking place. So we could go in and we could look at bond enthalpies. We could look at the energy of the reactants and the products. We could do all of those energy calculations that we would have done in a Chem1B sense. And that would give us some insight into why this reaction is taking place. And we could calculate out the delta G, and we would find out that the delta G is negative, and so the reaction moves forward. All of that's great. Yes, we can do all of that, but it still doesn't really hit at why the reaction is taking place. If we take a look at an energy diagram, and this is just a truncated energy diagram, that we can take a look at an energy diagram where we're looking at the orbitals, and there may be more orbitals that are below this and more orbitals that are above this. This is the orbitals of the incoming nucleophile. One particular orbital is important. This is the highest occupied molecular orbital. That highest occupied molecular orbital on the nucleophile is important relative to its position, because when I take a look at the LUMO or electrophile, so let's draw the electrophile over here. I'll draw it over here. And I'm going to take and move it down just a little bit. This is the electrophile. And the orbital that I'm interested in the electrophile is this one. This is the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. These two orbitals, this one, which constitutes being electron rich and is the highest occupied molecular orbital, and this one, which constitutes being electron poor and is the lowest unoccupied molecular orbital. The relative energies of these two are such that this one is higher in energy than this LUMO, and being higher in energy than the LUMO, as these electrons move and migrate over here into the LUMO, they come down in energy, and the system becomes lower in energy by the movement of the electrons from the electron-rich species in this case, the nucleophile, and over here, the electron poor species. Which is the electrophile. The energy difference between them is such that it is favorable for the electrons to fall, to go to a lower energy level. meaning that it becomes more energetically stable, more favorable. So that's what's actually taking place. It's the transfer of the electrons from the HOMO to the LUMO of why this actually takes place. So when we take a look at a chemical reaction then, and we draw a chemical reaction into this, let's say that we have a CH3, an oxygen nucleophile that has a negative charge, and we have some electrophile, that we can recognize these by their relative negative charges and partial charges, partial minus and partial positive in terms of the bromide and the carbon that's here. All right, and so we can see these. Now, where are these orbitals? What do these orbitals look like? This is my nucleophile and my electrophile. And I could probably guess in the nucleophile where the negative charge is, where the highest energy electrons are, where the HOMO is. I could take a look at the pair of electrons and I could say this pair of electrons here, that this guy here is probably the HOMO. And it doesn't have to be that pair. It could be any of those three pairs, but that negative charge is exemplified by a lone pair of electrons, and that is the HOMO. Then I could also say that somewhere this partial positive here represents the highest occupied or the lowest unoccupied, the LUMO. So this is the LUMO orbital. But the question is, I don't know what that LUMO looks like. And that understanding what the LUMO looks like would help me to understand this chemical reaction a little bit better. So there's two ways that we could look at the LUMO. We could look at the LUMO in terms of valence bonding theory, or we could look at it in terms of molecular orbital theory. But we need to get an idea of what that LUMO looks like. And both theories are valid. Both theories work, but they will give us slightly different pictures. Number one, we could take a valence bonding theory approach. So valence bonding theory, or this is oftentimes called natural bonding theory. In this case, what we're trying to do is we're trying to look at the sigma star bond. The sigma star is the antibonding orbital. And we want that for the leaving group. What we're looking for is the antibonding orbital. So in this case, what we were doing is if we take a look at the molecule, let's say that this is a carbon with a bromide in it, and I have these different groups attached here, that the orbitals, when I look at them, that this orbital, this is the dividing line, that this orbital is the sigma bond. This is the highest occupied molecular orbital. And that this one is the sigma star. This is the antibonding. And what I'm interested in is I'm interested in that LUMO sigma star and what it looks like. So what it looks like is if I take and draw pictures of these orbitals, the bonding orbital we have looked at in the past. That was one of the things that we did when we first started in the class, and we started looking at pictures of bonding and how these bonds get formed. So when I look at the carbon bond with the bromide, remember that that what happens is the carbon brings in the sp3 hybrid orbital. And there's two ways in which that sp3 hybrid orbital can come together. And it comes together with a bromide that probably is using, because it has p orbitals, s isn't, it's valence, it's a p orbital. So it probably is using a like an sp3 hybrid as well in this sense. And so I'm looking at the overlap of these two orbitals, and they can come together in phase or out of phase. So let's take this and let's put this over here. Let's say what happens when they come together in phase. Is they make a bond where the majority of the electron orbital sits in the middle, and there's a little side on each side here. So color-wise, this is an occupied orbital. Let's say that that orbital looks something like this. And we could go and we could pull it up on WebMO and we could look at it, but that's the sigma orbital and where the electrons are sitting. The sigma star is the opposite of that, where they retract from each other. And so what happens is I get no electron density in the center, and the electron density gets thrown to the outsides of these things. Oftentimes that correlates into something that looks more like this, where I have a larger orbital out here, a small circle here and here, and a larger orbital thrown out that side. And this is an empty orbital. And so I would color it correspondingly, alternating with the yellow and green. And there's no density, no electron density gluing this thing together or holding it together. And so this is the picture of the sigma star. That's one picture of what it looks like. The other picture that we could do is we could look at molecular orbital theory, and we can get a picture from molecular orbital theory. Now, molecular orbital theory, I can't explain in terms of the way that I would do valence bonding theory. We need to use WebMO. So here, all I can really do is draw for you what this looks like and give you a picture, not of the bonding orbital, but of the anti-bonding. So I'm just going to draw what the LUMO looks like. We get the carbon bound to the bromide. I'm going to use hydrogens in here for this one. And what this orbital looks like primarily is there is a very large orbital coefficient that resides in this area. I can't get it drawn the way I want. Come on. That's pretty close. There is another area that resides here, another large area that is mostly over the bromide, and then another fairly large lobe that's over here, and they get colored this way, alternating green and orange. And this is the MO LUMO, molecular orbital LUMO. And this is the largest coefficient that resides in the back over here. Largest coefficient meaning that it is the largest part of the lobe. Think of it as like the biggest target. Okay, so we have these two pictures. We have a picture where I have, for a single bond, what this sigma star orbital looks like. And I have a picture of molecular orbital theory, what it looks like when I look at the LUMO from molecular orbital theory. Both of them have a lobe that places it in the back of the molecule, back over here on the carbon side, opposite the bromide. What has to happen, what must happen, is that electrons from the nucleophile must be placed into the sigma star orbital to disrupt the sigma bond. Let's say disrupt and break. Okay, so why is that true? The easiest example that I can say of why that's true is that we noted very early on that hydrogen, when hydrogen came together and made a molecule, that hydrogen was diatomic because the bringing together of the two orbitals places electrons into the bonding orbital and the antibonding is empty. And this is how I make H2. And so this is the sigma bond and this is the sigma star. And hydrogen is diatomic. Helium is not diatomic. Helium, when you try to do the same thing, and I think we did this in the first few weeks, when you try to do the same thing with helium and you try to make H2, you wind up placing electron density in both the sigma and the sigma star. And because of that, helium won't make this and is not diatomic because electron density in a sigma star disrupts the bonding. In actuality, what's happening is that the bonding orbital is offset. Right, we're lower in energy. The system comes down to lower in energy by taking the electrons and putting them into the bonding orbital. And the antibonding orbital is higher in energy, but there's nothing in it. So overall, the system is lower in energy. If you put electrons into the antibonding orbital, it negates the bonding orbital's gain in energy. And therefore, it disrupts it. And so by putting electrons into the antibonding orbital, what we do is we break the bonding orbital. So that means that in order for this SN2 reaction to occur, what I need to do is I need to dump electrons into that antibonding orbital. And I'm going to do so where the lowest, largest coefficient is, because that's my largest target. So if I can dump electrons into this orbital, I can break the sigma bond and I can eject out this leaving group. Same thing if I look at it in natural bonding theory. Is that if I dump electron density into this side over here, I can disrupt what's going on and break the sigma bond. So both models are showing that the attack has to happen on the back side of the molecule. For an SN2, and this is the punchline, for SN2 reaction, both models show that the nucleophile must place its electrons into the antibonding orbital, and that antibonding orbital occurs on the backside of the carbon. The way we say that is must attack the backside In fact, we call it a backside attack. The backside of the carbon with the leaving group. To reach the sigma star. And that it must go that direction in order for the reaction to take place. So when I look at this reaction, the nucleophile can't hit anywhere at once. The nucleophile must hit the backside. And these electrons must attack that way. And it has to be a fairly narrow angle. It cannot attack it at any point. It can't hit the carbon on the front side. It can't hit from the top. It has to hit from the backside. The reason that it must hit from the backside is because it has to hit where that antibonding orbital is. So the majority of that antibonding orbital is sitting here, and it has to hit that antibonding orbital in what we call the backside in order to kick it out and to have the SN2 reaction go forward. So there's a geometry restriction to this reaction. In how the reaction must proceed. In order to break that sigma bond. That backside attack has all kinds of implications in terms of how the reaction proceeds. And we can get an idea of what it looks like by going back to the Hammond postulate. So, and that Hammond postulate is then going to inform us as to all the things that can affect this reaction and can tell us about that rate. But as I'm looking at the clock, and it is now 12:36, I've gone over my time a little bit in what I want to do. And so the way we're going to wrap this up is we're going to say, we're not going to get to that until next Tuesday. And it'll be the same bat time and the same bat channel. And we'll come back and we'll take a look at how that Hammond postulate can inform us as to the rate and why primaries go faster than secondaries, go faster than tertiaries, and how it's all tied into this backside attack and how it's all tied into Hammond postulate. All right. That's where I'm going to cut it. I'm going to wrap it up there. I'm going to wish you all a good weekend, and I'll see you back on Monday for lab and Tuesday for lecture.
So I just wanted to make